So I want to bring up another case. We can come back to this one if you have any other comments. But Ben, this is a patient who's 51 years old, a young patient. This patient has actually metastatic squamous cell presented with mets in the brain, liver, and bones, PD-L1 negative, got radiation therapy to the brain, got put on carboplatin PEM, a little bit of a response, really didn't do that great, and then had disease progression, and currently receiving second-line therapy with docetaxel and ramucirumab. And the questions that Dr. Polkinghorne from Maine had was one of the questions, kind of a little bit of, you know, why is it that we can use ramucirumab in squamous cell, but we can't use bevacizumab, and is it safe to do that? This patient seems to be progressing very well. So that's one question. Is it safe to use it in a patient with squamous cell? Do you use it? So here's Dr. Polkinghorne on Zoom from Augusta, Maine.
So I have two questions. First, in the setting again of squamous cell carcinoma, metastatic, how comfortable are investigators using ramucirumab in a disease where we do not, by guidelines, use bevacizumab? It's not approved. And my second question is, if he progresses through docetaxel and ramucirumab, what would be your third line option for this relatively young gentleman? Would you consider gemcitabine, even though he has really blown through cytotoxic chemotherapy? And would afatinib be of interest to you?
Ben, this is a younger patient. What might be next? I don't know what's going on exactly right now with clinical research, but I know it's, you know, it's definitely hit an obstacle. But are there trials, at least that were available prior to COVID, that a patient like this could consider? And what about off trial? How do you approach third line therapy? So Ben, can you take a crack at discussing that?
Yeah, I think that this is a patient that has been appropriately managed. I think that we at least know from the REVEL trial that roughly 20 to 25% of patients in that trial, and this was a trial evaluating docetaxel ramucirumab compared to docetaxel in platinum refractory patients. We know that a quarter of these patients were squamous cell and that the drug, we didn't see any bleeding events that would prohibit giving this drug in a squamous cell patient population. I think, and I'll defer to John on this because he certainly has a tremendous amount of experience on Bev, but clearly we saw some safety signals in the phase 1/2 with bleeding, and I'm not sure we have seen these with ramucirumab. So I think based on at least the phase 3 data, we certainly, I think a patient with squamous cell should be offered the opportunity to see the combination of docetaxel and ramucirumab. And Neil, as we've talked about before one-on-one, I think the challenge with this regimen is not the ramucirumab, it's the docetaxel, which kind of leads me to the next point of, you know, what do we really need in this space? And it's really good clinical trials. And I think clinical trial opportunities exist, of course, in the second lines for patients who are progressing on platinum-based chemotherapy. And we try very hard to put all of our patients second line on clinical trials rather than default to standard of care. And that's because every subsequent line of therapy, you lose an opportunity to treat the patient. So I would say even in the second line here, our default would be to do or try a clinical trial. But in this patient who got docetaxel ramucirumab, what I would do next off study would most likely, if the patient wasn't responding to docetaxel ramucirumab, would most likely be something like single agent gemcitabine, given that that is an active agent in squamous cell. I think on study, the sky is the limit. I think there are multiple competing strategies out there. I will just throw out some of the ones that we're doing, and I know is being done across some of the institutions that these speakers are from. But bottom line is, this patient is being appropriately treated with docetaxel ramucirumab. Off study, third line, I would offer gem.
So, Leora, this patient did pretty well on immunotherapy with chemotherapy. What about post-immunotherapy, immunotherapy? In other words, for example, ipi-nivo or a combination like that?
I think everything's being looked at. I'm not sure that I'm excited about any of it. You know, I think we've just had so many big failures that the post-IO, you know, every single combo is out there. But there's nothing right now that hits me as a clear winner. Probably what I'm least excited about is nivo-ipi, and we're still seeing that. I've actually seen patients come in getting that post-failure of IO. You know, we have a bunch of trials going on looking at combos post-IO, but nothing seems to be hitting it out of the ballpark the way the single-agent drugs just did on their own in the second line and chemo failures.
So it's interesting about ipi/nivo. So you're saying you're seeing people having that suggested to them. When they come to you for a second opinion, do you go, well, you know, that's an evidence-based strategy, but I don't really do it, or that's just not a good idea?
Probably more excited about docetaxel ramucirumab than I am about ipi/nivo. I do use a reduced dose of docetaxel at the 60, like Japanese dose, rather than the 75 milligrams per meter squared. But I generally will talk patients out of that and talk them into a clinical trial if they don't want to go to a chemotherapy strategy.
So Melissa, one thing I, you know, again, just from the general medical oncology perspective, because, you know, Ben's comment about the docetaxel there is well taken, older patients in particular. But, you know, general medical oncologists are used to using ramucirumab and paclitaxel for gastric cancer. They use it all the time. It's second line therapy. It sort of seems like it would be a natural substitution, but I know there's a lot of reluctance based on data. Is that something you ever consider?
It's a good point, Neil, that I think the paclitaxel dose, if I'm not mistaken, is lower. And I think it's weekly for PAC plus RAMU as opposed to the docetaxel that's every 3 weeks. So that's one way that taxanes are more common. You know, I agree with Ben and Leora's comments. You know, I tend to think twice about docetaxel ramucirumab. It adds 1 month of overall survival, 1 month of PFS. And I think the combination effort does have toxicity. I think the oncology community is borrowing the data from melanoma when they use nivo/ipi in the second line. I think there we do see that you can cycle through immunotherapy drugs. It does appear to be more difficult to do that in lung cancer. And as Leora said, some of these efforts to sort of reactivate the immune system or reverse immune evasion or resistance have not yet been promising. I did want to add to all of the trial comments that antibody drug conjugates are a particular strategy that I'm more excited about in the second line and beyond for lung cancer and breast cancer. They're using them. They are FDA approved there. We have a lot of antibody drug conjugate trials ongoing, many versus docetaxel. I think that'll be something that we talk about more in the future on these meetings as well.
We did a whole entire symposium in San Antonio on HER2-positive disease, and I was shocked when I started to see the data in HER2-low and that it was being used outside of breast cancer. Have you seen actual responses in lung cancer to this drug?
So that drug targets HER2. It's an antibody drug conjugate. Exatecan is the payload. And it is, as you said, being used for a lot of breast cancer patients with HER2 expression. In contrast, the trials that are evaluating this in lung have been for HER2 mutated lung cancer, and that's a much smaller patient population. We are participating in that trial. We have other antibody drug conjugates with other targets that are more prevalent in lung cancer. We have a HER3 ADC, for example, a TROP2 ADC. There are other, a PTK7 ADC. The common denominator among all of these trials and the field in general is that the target is super relevant. And so beyond oncogene mutations, it appears that we will need to do biopsies and look at tumor tissue for patients after frontline therapy to understand what the best next treatment will be. I think that's the next wave, and I'm really excited about it. We've seen some great responses.
John?
Yeah, so I agree that the patient's been managed appropriately to this far with the right approved agents. But at this point, I would really reconsider one important strategy that hasn't been mentioned, which is actually doing next generation sequencing here. And in fact, we would typically do it for squams up front. Now, I know there's some controversy about do you do it routinely for all patients with squamous histology or just squamous non-smokers? So we just reported a study last year. Vincent Lam is actually the first author of this, who's now at Johns Hopkins. And for more than 400 patients with squamous carcinoma, if you do NGS, about 10% of them have actionable alterations. And so this includes about 3% that have EGFR mutation, you know, about 2% have ROS1 or ALK. And the big one, the one that's going to become most relevant this year, is about 5% have MET exon 14. Because we expect in the next year, it's likely that capmatinib or tepotinib is going to become FDA approved for MET exon 14. So now if you're talking about 10%, that's a substantial group that can really get benefit from targeted agents. So I would just try to remind everybody, don't forget about NGS for squamous patients, particularly given that this case, the patient was younger, age 51. We don't know if it was a smoker or not, but I wouldn't let that impact. You know, smoking doesn't prevent you from getting an EGFR mutation or a ROS1 mutation. So don't forget about NGS in those patients.
So I just got to follow up, though. When you say you see 10%, that's, I mean, in the past, as I said earlier, I've heard people say, okay, well, maybe it's mixed. There's a small tissue. You know, you're not really sure what it is. But 10% of for real squamous cell?
Yeah, it's a great question. This is patients who are diagnosed at our cancer center as squamous histology is the bulk of that data set. Now, is the diagnosis always perfect? Well, sometimes you only get a needle biopsy in the real world and you got to make a call on it. But this is what happens in the real world. So this is sort of a real world experience. Patients who are being called squamous, they're being treated as squamous, and 10% of them have an actionable alteration. Now, you might say, well, that's lower than non-squamous, you know, which is 30 or 40%. But I don't think that's the right comparator. I think you're saying, okay, does doing this potentially help a substantial number of patients where they could get a targeted therapy? And I think the answer is yes, especially as we have MET exon 14 drugs becoming available. To my mind, that's where it becomes even more important to do NGS for your squamous cell patients when we have the MET exon 14 drugs available in the clinic.
I believe capmatinib was approved this week.
Yeah, capmatinib was approved like yesterday, I think. Yeah.
Oh, so was it yesterday? Okay, I'm a day behind. All right.
they come flying in, you know. But just to go back to the question that came up before, John, since you're the angiogenesis person, why is it that it's safe? I mean, I know empirically they didn't see bleeding when they gave ramucirumab in squamous, but is there a biologic reason or just the way they did the trial? Why is it?
Yeah, good question. So first of all, empirically, we know it's true from multiple studies. So not only the REVEL study that Ben mentioned with ramucirumab plus docetaxel, we did the ZEST study with vendetinib plus docetaxel with squamous, and there was no bleeding signal there in the squamous. There have been studies with nintedanib in the squamous where it's been safe. All these in the second line setting, it looks like VEGF inhibitors are safe. There isn't a big data set for bevacizumab, so it's hard to know if it's a bevacizumab issue or it's a second line setting. I suspect in the second line setting, you could do this safely as long as patients didn't have big, bulky central tumors. I think what happens in the first line setting, the tumors are very fragile before they've gotten any therapy, or the vasculature is very leaky, especially when you've got large central vessels. But after patients have gotten initial chemotherapy, you've had some debulking, a lot of those fragile vessels that are prone to bleeding are probably weeded out. So we're not sure of the reason, but there's multiple studies that say squamous patients can be treated with angiogenesis inhibitors in the second line setting.